Father God and pray. He said, Lord, I tell a brother how he can get some tea.
Africans brought to America as slaves brought with them not one, but tens of languages. Placed in disparate groupings and sold from one owner to another, they made English, or sometimes French, their language of communication.
This brother gone and Lord sent him there, and the brother gone there, and sit on the edge of the razor and sit on the edge.
The lowland Negro of South Carolina has a barbaric dialect. The English words seem to tumble all at once from his mouth and to get sadly mixed when he endeavors to speak.
And you won't go up there and see the land places.
The slave trade officially is no longer allowed into America from 1808, and really most slaves came into America before the Revolution, which is 1776 to 1783. By the time you get down to the 19th century, most slaves are American-born, and English is the language, but often it's a black English, so it differs slightly from English, which can have a disconcerting impact on white observers. Whites will often talk about the bad grammar of slaves talking. What in actual fact is happening, because there is a difference in the way many blacks spoke and sounded in the 19th century. The grammar is often obeying rules and laws that come from Africa.
Let your daughter up here in the land place, see they're having a good time there. And you want to carry a son up there for you, or want to see the...
It was a common academic view, well down to after World War II, that the way blacks spoke would be traced by linguists back to the way Cornish people spoke in England. Africa was seen not to have had any influence on African-American culture. The dominant view amongst historians, anthropologists, sociologists, down into the 1950s, was that Africa was wiped out the moment the slaves were ripped out of Africa and taken to the New World, and that the slaves in the New World were tabula rasa. They were blank slates on which whites, be they Spanish, Portuguese, or Puritans, imprinted their culture. One of the most revealing sources of slave life are a series of interviews conducted in the 1930s as part of the New Deal, in which people were employed to go around and find anyone in the South who was born and lived as a slave who was still alive and interview them about slavery. And there is some controversy about the fact that much of this stuff is rendered in dialects. One of my favourite pieces from these slave interviews was a former slave named Lorenzo Ezell, who made it clear to his interviewer exactly how he wanted his words to be put down on paper. And he said, be sure and put it because instead of because. Because us didn't say because. I said because. Us didn't say then, I said then. I said dem and does and dees and wid and hab and an and usta and gwan, gonna. And, of course, he was right to insist on those corrections. Nowadays, some scholars who use this material go through and silently correct it. I happen to disagree with that. This guy is very clear about the way he wants to be put down in speech.
Voice is the sound made by something with a soul. Although some things may be said to have a voice, for example the pipe, the lyre, and other things which lack a soul, but have variation in pitch, melody, and articulation, there is a likeness here because voice too has these properties. Aristotle, On the Soul, Book 2, Chapter 8.
We do have a very large number of treatises on oral presentation. We have guides to correct projection and enunciation. The study of rhetoric itself was originally the study of oratory.
Bruce Johnson is visiting professor of cultural theory at the University of Turku in Finland. He's been researching the politics and power implications of the voice.
Up until the ascendancy of print, and still afterwards, but not to the same extent, the question of vocal communication was of great interest. Francis Bacon wrote about vocal communication. What's the best way to do business with people using your voice? It was a highly auditory era. With the arrival of print, we had a new information economy. And the ascendancy of print, or the consolidation of print as the medium of authoritative knowledge, is marked very strongly by Samuel Johnson's English Dictionary in the 18th century.
I have attempted a dictionary of the English language. When I took the first survey of my undertaking, I found our speech copious without order and energetic without rules. Wherever I turned my view, there was perplexity to be disentangled and confusion to be regulated.
He made a conscious decision, which he talks about in his preface, to include only words that had been written down. He would not include words that had not been written down. And what this really meant was the languages that were used by the underclasses. Why were they not written down? Because many of the underclasses could not write. So Johnson really defined two kinds of linguistic community, those who could write and those who could not. And those who could not, that is, those who could only make sound, who could only speak, were relegated to a lower class of citizen.
Which it is the duty of the lexicographer to correct or prescribe.
The right to call a sound noise, as opposed to, say, information or music, is one of the ways in which we can trace power relations, certainly from the medieval period. Noise is not an objective entity. It's a value judgment we impose upon a particular kind of sound. It's the weed in the sound garden. Who decides what is noise and what is meaningful information tells us an enormous amount about the particular power relations at any given moment in a social formation.
You're listening to Hindsight. Today, hearing about the work of a number of historians who've set out to listen to the past. It's been a subject of considerable interest in North America, where the soundscape of slavery spoke loudly to the abolitionist North. The North itself was heard by the South, and they didn't like what they heard.
Anyone who walks the streets of New York with his eyes and ears open sees and hears many strange and horrid things. Poverty, sickness, filth, crime and wretchedness echo in one ear, while the silk rustles of the sashaying skirts of the ladies sound in the other.
People in the South were careful listeners, both literally and figuratively. Now, literally, when they travelled north, for example, to, say, New York City, what did they hear? What did they listen for? Well, what they heard was noise, as many of them understood it. They heard the noise of the mob, the noise of excessive democracy, the noise of industrialism, the noise of urbanism. It was the isms that they objected to most strenuously, because those isms were proxy for social dislocation in their own world, which is why they had resisted it so strenuously. But they also listened figuratively, because they read, and what did they read? Well, they read these travel accounts from other Southerners, and these travel accounts then circulated these acoustic stereotypes of Northern urbanism. And of course, it created a very clumsy image of the North, just as the North had a very clumsy acoustic image of the South. The North was not largely urban by 1860, it was largely rural, and some of those rural soundscapes in the North were not unlike those in the South. But we're talking about perceptions, and the way that that acoustic stereotype circulated rendered sectional identity quite concrete, so that people began to think that the entire slave South was wholly agricultural and the entire modernizing North was wholly urban. And it was those stereotypes, I think, that in a way fed the coming of the Civil War. It certainly misrepresented each region, but we often work on misrepresentations and they become real in and of themselves.
The South is known for being mostly rural. There are not that many cities as such in the South. But slavery didn't just exist in the South, it existed in the North, and there are large concentrations of slaves and also free blacks living in Charleston, Richmond, and places like that. It's a particularly interesting area, I think, for the sonic history. We have a number of different sources that point to the fact that in places like New Orleans, much of the sound of New Orleans was created by blacks, and there is this huge variety of black languages, blacks driving coaches and singing and talking and yelling, an incredible black life.
Black women with huge baskets of rusks, rolls and other appurtenances of the breakfast table, crying in loud, shrill French their stock in trade, followed by milk criers and butter criers and criers of everything but tears.
It was not just black voices that made African-American sounds. There's a variety of other ways in which blacks could make sounds. Clapping, patting juba, keeping in time with your hands, clapping your hands together, clapping your hands against your body and your hands. They're improvised musical instruments, percussion in particular, you know, tin pots and all sorts of things are being used. Even something like whistling. There's this one wonderful account from the urban slave south from Lynchburg in Virginia in which someone actually wrote about the whistling that was going on in Lynchburg and how as you were walking down the street there were blacks lounging against the walls sort of looking at whites as the whites were walking along the streets and whistling. And then just doing interesting little things with the pitch and with the volume of the whistling. Some whites, particularly white women, could feel intimidated as they're walking down the streets. And as well as this, there are groups of blacks who are doing whistling contests, cutting contests. Someone will whistle a bit of a rhythm and then someone else will embellish that rhythm, and it's a question to see who can do it the best. This is familiar to us through cutting contests in jazz nowadays, but blacks were doing this with their voices, whistling in the 1850s. You know, it's not as though whites couldn't and didn't whistle as well, but the way blacks did this and the way they introduced a competitive element into the cutting contest, they actually seized something like this and made it particularly African-American and could use it in order to claim and stake a claim to the actual space of the streets.
Good morning, Mr. Atkinson.
There's a large movement towards the end of the 19th century, which you can see also in Britain and the United States and other British colonies, to reform education, to make children into much more self-conscious citizens, to make them participate in the cultural life of the country rather more than had been sort of emphasised earlier on. And participating in the cultural life of the country meant being able to speak, to use your voice in local politics and that sort of thing.
Once upon a time, a long time ago, children had to read aloud.
So there's an emphasis in this period on speech. And when they talked about reading, the need to teach children to read, very often, I mean, almost invariably, they meant reading out loud. And there's an enormous emphasis on the clarity and articulation with which you read out loud. Sometimes even beginning to seem more important than actually understanding what you were reading. It's all about reading out loud and reading in a particular, clear and correct fashion.
I love the sunburnt country, a land of sweeping plains, of ragged mountain ranges, of droughts and flooding rains. I love her far horizon.
So there's a new emphasis on oral articulation, what you sounded like in school. And that's linked in by the end of the 19th century with the new ideas about nationhood, that, okay, we're going to sound correct. Correct means sounding the same as everyone else. It's an index of nationality and national belonging and therefore of citizenship, and that you should lose your connection with your class, your distinctive class, so you shouldn't sound working class. But even more, perhaps, more important, you should lose your connection with little places within the nation so that the whole population belongs to the whole nation. All sounding alike was almost as important as all looking alike, the whitest Australia policy. which is obviously a much more famous aspect of Australian nationalism. But this idea of sounding the same was very important too. Sort of intimacy of uniformity, if you like. All of our voices coming out from our insides are similar. Source material is very important, but there's also reports from school inspectors. The vastness of the educational bureaucracy in this period and the need to record everything means that you have very detailed accounts by school inspectors about how children sounded, whether they were dropping their H's or not in particular places, whether they'd stamped out the Cornish accent in the copper mining towns at Kapunda, etc. There's a new interest in geography as well, and a new capability in dealing with large spaces. And the idea of having a single large space, such as Australia, such as the British Empire, filled with voices of all the same sort, is fascinating. It's an intriguing possibility that you can encompass within a large expanse of the world that kind of uniformity. And I don't know, human beings love uniformity. When imagination fails, go for uniformity. And imagination frequently does fail. And that seems to be what's happening in the late 19th century.
Sound can define space. Sound can determine allegiance. But it's unavoidable that sound passes.
I remember hearing, when I was very little, the horses clopping down Rathmines Road delivering milk.
Like clip-clop down the street, concrete street where I lived.
And it was a comforting sound.
I lived in the country and running down the road to school to catch the bus on a gravel road, which is now, you know, bitumen, you know, asphalt, whatever.
So running on a gravel road makes quite a particular sound, does it?
It does. But it's sort of a crunchy, noisy sound as you're pounding along.
You could make the case, well, you can't talk about the history of the past and the sound of the past without hearing it, but I'm not convinced. The written word was really the first recorder in many ways, and it captured not the sounds per se, but the meanings that people attach to sounds. And it is those meanings that I think are the most interesting things to excavate historically. And there's a real methodological problem here. Let's say it is technically possible to reproduce the sound of, say, a hammer hitting an anvil from 1800. What would that actually give us? Well, not really much. I mean, what we need to know is not the actual decibel level, although that's interesting. We don't really need to hear it again. What we need to know is what people at the time thought about that sound, how they interpreted that sound, the language they used to describe it, and the larger meaning attached to that sound. So just because you can't reproduce the actual sounds of the past, or at least in a pre-recorded era, doesn't mean that you can't get to grips with the sounds of the past.
Trying to recover sound history, the history of sound, is actually very difficult, because once a sound is made, it's gone forever. And sound can't be rendered that well onto the printed page. It actually is quite difficult. All those travellers who went through the South, some of them are extremely aware of the importance of sound and will write about it. Others appear to have been stone deaf. You know, there are people who go to Congo Square in New Orleans and write an account of it, and you think, please, couldn't you say something about the sound? Didn't you notice what was going on? So different sources are of different use on this, and making generalizations about the way sound is moving is fraught with difficulty.
There aren't any banjos here. There aren't any ocarinas. There's no riff-raff with a phonograph performing on concertinas. There's only a million gum trees, and nothing much else to mention. And trees don't speak more than once a week, and nobody pays any attention. Only the bush by night, with Jupiter shining clear, you can listen with all your might. This is all you'll hear. Silence. Kenneth Slessor.
Silence became
the dominant aspect of the explorer's acoustic journeys in Australia. And you see this almost from the beginning. If we take the explorations of John Oxley, for example, of the, one of the earliest explorers of the river systems of eastern Australia in 1817 and 1818. Now, Oxley goes driven by an economic imperative. He's looking for land. He's not listening to land. He's looking for land for settlement. He's disoriented by the sounds he hears because they seem so sparse and disordered. You begin to get this sort of coded oral message in his diaries that the biggest obstacle is the oral terrain to the psychological possession of Australia. And it's an obstacle because what he's hearing, apart from the occasional environmental sound, is basically silence. And the language that he uses and explorers generally use to describe silence, there's a lot of continuity in it. Dismal, gloomy, appalling, awful, death-like. So if we reflect on the words that are missing, they don't say peaceful, they don't say mysterious or astonishing. It's just incredibly gloomy and undermining for them.
The silence and solitude of this mighty waste were appalling to the mind, and I almost regretted that I had sworn to conquer it. Ernest Giles, 1874.
Sound becomes an inescapable aspect of the way they respond to much of Australia, to the point, I think, that there's a tendency to withdraw from much of the continent. In a way, sound becomes marginalised. People cling to the coast, to areas of greater fertility, to where they can hear the ocean, sounds from which they can derive a positive oral message. An equation develops between silence and space. The interior of Australia becomes a non-place, in part because it's a non-sound. I think it's no accident that the sound of waves, it's the sound of the beach, that becomes a major acoustic in Australian identity.
Arguably in the 1850s and just before the Civil War, there seems to be more people, more whites, who are aware of the value and the differences of black culture, who are going to the churches to listen to the blacks, who appreciate it. There seems to be a sort of a convergence of the cultures. And it's as though after, you know, over 200 years of living cheek by jowl in the South, a larger proportion of whites are suddenly aware of the culture that's produced by the people that they have enslaved for the previous two centuries.
Shouts and groans, terrific shrieks and indescribable expressions of ecstasy, of pleasure or agony, foot stamping, hand clapping, echoed through the building. My own muscles all stretched as if ready for a struggle, my face glowing, my feet stamping, having been infected unconsciously with an instinctive bodily sympathy with the excitement of the crowd.
Representations of slavery in TV series or in film tend not to do that well, but by the lights of what we've discovered researching sounds and slavery in the last 5 or 10 years. For the most part, if someone's making a film about slavery, they're perfectly happy just to put a blues track over it, which is anachronistic. People are beginning to think more about it nowadays. So, for example, there are any number of historical museums on the East Coast and in the South of America where they have reenactments. And nowadays they are incorporating sound into that. They're very keen to have people come and talk to the historical reenactors about what plantation life, what urban life sounded like and the sorts of sounds that African Americans made as they were going about their work. But That's very recent. That's very recently.
19th century America, its tensions rising into civil war, is a very different place from Australia at the same time. Yet the significance of certain sounds resonates across both. The power of silence, the sound of the other. The importance of uniformity and what defined noise. Attending to the sounds of the past might not be a ready route to answers about times gone by. But what it does offer, perhaps, is a new set of questions.
It adds texture to the past. Just as we live our lives in a full sensory capacity in which all of our senses are engaged in the world, I think it's appropriate and helpful to recognise that people in the past did too. If we don't attend to the acoustomology of the past, then we're sort of treating them as unhearing people.
What Graham White and myself and a whole bunch of other historians are trying to do is shifting history away from being about the elite. We are consciously writing about ordinary slaves, and trying to recover their history, the history of everyday life, requires a certain amount of creativity in looking at sources and using sources. But clearly, the senses as a whole, not just sound, are part of what constitutes everyday life. You can get into arguments with historians as to whether the senses, and sound in particular, or the senses generally, constitute a new field of history, and that there are many historians now who do write about this. To my way of thinking, it's not a separate field. What we're trying to do is heighten the awareness, the sonic awareness, if you will, of all historians, so that every historian who's writing about, you know, if someone's writing about Sydney in the first couple of decades, actually to consciously think at some point about what it sounded like. It just becomes part of the arsenal of tools that are available for historians when they're trying to recover the past. Because if you think about it, you know, sound is an important part of everyday lived experience.
And Odysseus climbed aboard himself, and down he lay, all quiet, as crewmen sat to the oarlocks, each in line, and the ship, like a four-horse team careering down the plain, all breaking as one with the whiplash cracking smartly. So the stern hove high and plunged with the seething rollers, crashing dark in her wake as she surged unwavering.
The words of Homer's Odyssey conclude today's Hindsight. Thanks to all the contributors to the program Hearing the Past, particularly Professor Shane White from the University of Sydney. The reader was Glenda Linscott, and thanks to sound performers Cameron Fairweather, Ingrid Hain, Manolis Mavromarkis, Michael Taft, and Class 43S, St Bridges Primary School in Mordialloc, Melbourne. Details of recent books about sound history are listed on our website at abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. Hearing the Past was produced by Jennifer Bowen, with sound production by Alex Stinson and Gary Havrillet.